Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you here on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Got a terrific show with you today with someone who's been on the program many times before and hopefully will be many times again. Our guest will be Sundiata Chajua from the Afro-American Studies program here at the University of Illinois. Before we talk to Sundiata, though, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The congressional wheels are in motion on a drive to keep webcasting alive. Draconian royalty rates for streaming radio stations are set to go into effect on July 15th. The expected costs of the new rate structure will bankrupt every webcaster save those with the deepest pockets. The new royalty system is essentially a ploy by the major label music industry to forcibly take over the nascent business of webcasting by depriving it of content. Last month, members of the House of Representatives introduced the Internet Radio Equality Act, which would nullify the new rate system and replace it with something that both commercial and non-commercial webcasters can afford to live with while fairly and properly compensating the owners of copyrighted music. That bill already has more than five dozen co-sponsors and awaits committee hearings. A companion bill is now circulating in the Senate as well. It still remains to be seen whether Congress and the White House will move quickly enough to stop the crippling rates from taking effect just 2 months from now. Visit www.freepress.net/netradio to watch the clock.
A full-court press is on to challenge an FCC edict that diminishes local government control over the cable television franchising process. In March, the FCC promulgated a rule that forces cities and towns to grant franchises in 90 days or less to phone and cable companies wanting to provide service. Groups such as the U.S. Conference of Mayors, National League of Cities, and Alliance for Community Media say that severely handicaps local authority to negotiate fair terms for the use of public rights of way, where the phone and cable companies lay their wires. In April, a coalition of local government and citizens media groups filed coordinated lawsuits against the FCC ruling in six U.S. courts of appeal. They've all since been consolidated in the Sixth Circuit, which is located in Cincinnati, Ohio. In the meantime, the combined lobbying juggernaut of the phone and cable companies is trying to do an end run around federal law on cable TV by pushing legislation through at the state level that streamlines the franchise process at the expense of local authority and higher rates. More than a dozen states have already capitulated, and another 20 or so are on the verge of following suit. Visit the Free Press State Policy Tracker at www.freepress.net/state tracker to keep abreast of what your own phone and cable companies are up to where you live.
Companies fighting the drive to make network neutrality the online law of the land are back with more shady tactics designed to confuse the public over the issue. In the state of Oregon, residents are receiving automated telemarketing calls urging them to call Senator Gordon Smith to oppose any congressional intervention into the net neutrality debate. The recorded message portrays the issue as a fight between phone and cable companies and big internet firms like Google and Yahoo, when in reality, network neutrality is all about the rights of citizens to freely communicate online without paying extra tolls to the phone and cable companies that already provide them with internet access. A bill to restore network neutrality, called the Internet Freedom Preservation Act, is pending in the Senate and has 10 sponsors so far, including Oregon's other senator, Ron Wyden. Just recently, a group calling itself the American Consumer Institute sprouted up, touting a new report which claims a federal network neutrality law would cost consumers billions of dollars in higher internet connection fees. The problem is the American Consumer Institute is nothing but a front for a former chief economist of the phone company now known as Verizon, who still moonlights as a consultant for the telecom industry. If you go to ACI's website, though, nowhere does it mention this obvious conflict of interest.
It was supposed to be such an easy deal, Earlier this spring, Clear Channel Communications, the nation's biggest owner of radio stations, outdoor billboards, and large music venues, drew up a plan to sell itself to a private equity firm for a cool $20 billion. Clear Channel's founders would make a mint, but institutional shareholders revolted, claiming they would lose money on the transaction. Since then, Clear Channel's renegotiated the sellout for a price closer to the $30 billion mark, though it's delayed a shareholder vote on the deal for a third time to May 22nd in order to lobby stockholders harder for the bid's approval. Meanwhile, Clear Channel's gone ahead with plans to divest itself of the 56 TV stations it owns to another private firm named Providence Equity Partners. The $1.2 billion deal is chump change compared to the entire privatization of the rest of the Clear Channel empire, but it's notable for another reason. One of Providence's primary telecom investment advisors is none other than former FCC Chairman Michael Powell.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Joining you today for another program, our guest today, the director of the African American Studies Program at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, Professor Sindiata Chajua. Sindiata, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here, Bob.
It's a pleasure to have you here. You've been on the show a couple times before, discussing your research in the past, discussing a year ago we had you on talking about the Black Power Conference that that you helped organize here on campus that was really an extraordinary event on this campus. People are still talking about it. And a subject, I think, of continuing significance and importance for everyone here on this campus.
Well, actually, I think it's had a real national impact. We brought about 800 to 1,000 people, and probably half came from outside the campus. And certainly, if you look at recent publications, Black Power is the hot intellectual topic in African-American studies today.
Well, and it all started here. Well, unfortunately, not all good things start here. You know, one of the reasons I want to do this show with you is that over the last year, there have been a number of really troubling racist events on this campus involving U of I undergrads, criticizing other students of color and faculty of color here on the U of I campus, employing derogatory and racist terms and caricatures. And, you know, it's something that, you know, I just, you know, it hasn't gotten a lot of attention, certainly not nationally. It's gotten some. And I just wanted to put this in perspective. I mean, what is going on? And is it something that's been going on that no one just noticed for the last 10 or 15 years? Or is this sort of a bump in the road? Something new has been going on this last year?
You know, I think you hit on something that's really accurate, Bob, that, of course, this kind of stuff has been going on for a long time. This is the United States. You know, when I say that, I mean it in the way that Bernie Mac on his television show, when he says, I'm speaking to America, meaning I'm talking to the essence of America, which is a white racist society. So, yeah, it's been here, but I do think that it escalated this year. And I think the reasons for the escalation are, of course, many. In some ways, it connects to national trends. We've had an escalation across the nation in regard to racist discourse and racist practices, from Don Imus to the comedian Michael Richards, on and on and on. So there's that aspect. There's also, I think, the anxiety around the chief, but particularly the failure on the part of university system leadership to prepare the institution for the removal of the chief in a way that was honest and that squared with the actual history of the chief and why the chief was created and maintained all these years. What I'm trying to get at is that had institutional leadership been forthright and said, yes, the chief is a racist symbol, the people who constructed it, some of them clearly understood it as a racist symbol. Others didn't fully comprehend it, and while people celebrated it without necessarily a malignant heart, the reality, the objective reality, is that it was a caricature, a racist caricature of Native people, and then moved in to talk about why it was important to move beyond that and prepare the campus in terms of an educational process of how we can uncover, right, racist practices that we haven't necessarily recognized as that, and put us into a process to think about it in those terms, we'd be much further off. But by the cowardice, the intellectual cowardice in refusing to do that on the part of system leadership, put us in a situation where then students make up their own interpretation as to what's going on, as opposed to be guided through that.
Cindy, a lot of our listeners are listening to us over the air in East Central Illinois in the Champaign-Urbana metropolitan area and over into Indiana. But we also get a lot of people now listen to us online who are getting podcasts, callers from all over the country, even from Europe sometimes. For people who are not familiar with the chief, because I think that probably slid by a number of our listeners, if you could just in a nutshell just explain what we're talking about when we talk about the chief here.
We're talking about the equivalent of a dancing black lawn jockey.
But I mean, it's
the mascot of the University of Illinois for the athletic teams.
For the athletic teams.
It's a guy dressed up as a Native American performing a dance that has no relationship to Native American culture. It's
been a source of tremendous controversy,
tension, and anxiety for a long time. And while it's, it was a reflection of what the campus was like. So I don't want to put it all on the chief, but I do want to say that in terms of dealing with the process that needed to be put in place to prepare us to interrogate what the chief, this racist mascot, that wasn't done. And I think that so there's a certain amount of anxiety that was on the campus, and that anxiety has been galvanized this past year as students acted out in a number of ways. And one example is, of course, the race-themed parties. But it went beyond student-student behavior and entered into I'll call them racial microaggressions on faculty in a number of programs, but particularly I'm talking now about African-American studies. We had one student who, given an assignment in African-American studies history class, decided to entitle the paper the N-word and turn it in. Couldn't really comprehend what the problem was initially. And then when confronted with it, came with a story that maybe a roommate changed his title. We had another incident where, and this one I think it's the most galling of all that we experienced. A year ago last spring, a group of student teachers took a class from a Black Studies faculty who's also in the College of Education. And that professor, in trying to explain a racist cartoon that was embedded in a story about African Americans, and the cartoon was of a donkey. And the professor was trying to explain how the symbol had been racialized in connection with the story. So a year after that discussion and debate, the students, of course, thought that was her imagination. A year later, a group of students decided to organize a drunken bar crawl. They're going to get drunk at 2 p.m., they're going to drink to 5 a.m., and they advertised a party by using the first name of our professor on Facebook. And for her picture, what should have been the picture of the host, they put a baying donkey. And, we took issue with this and challenged it. And the chair of the department in which the student was taking the course, initially didn't see it as a big deal and ultimately put in place a process that involved this student journaling her experiences. So, in effect, nothing of significance.
And if I can add, this was an assistant professor?
This was a second-year assistant professor, a young woman.
Let me just add, for those of our listeners not familiar with academia, That is tends to be the lowest on the food chain in the university hierarchy. If you're an assistant professor in your first or second year, you don't have a whole heck of a lot of power in our system.
Very, very little power. And one of the direct consequences that we can figure out that came out of this, this young woman in fall semester came to us with the idea that she wanted to develop a professional name. She has an ethnic African-American name, and the students used to make fun of the name as she would come in and out of class. And so she decided that she wanted to change her name so that she wouldn't be subject to this kind of harassment. Mm-hmm. We, of course, convinced her to defend the name because the name reflects, you know, kind of legacy of African-American people in the sense that very few young black men and black girls can go to one of those, say, a pharmacy where they sell those little name tags and find their name.
Yeah.
Right? Our names are not up there. So we thought, you know, defend the name. But when you understand that it was a response to this kind of racist assault, so that it has deep kinds of impact, you know, that they become troubling in a way that it impacts the individual. And these are just two cases. You know, we've done discussions with a number of students, and the number of things that don't even rise to the level of a complaint from students on a day-to-day basis is absolutely frightening. The amount of things that get washed out of the system. Now, whether they get resolved or whether they just lie there to fester, you know, I can't say. But I know that they never make it to the media. Just to give you one quick example.
Okay.
Freshman, first-year black student has a history of having been in ballet, wants to take a class in dance for class for majors. So you have to do a tryout. She successfully tries out, gets admitted to the class. She comes to the class. The teacher announced to the class, we have a new student, da-da-da-da. No one says welcome. The teacher doesn't even say welcome. Doesn't appoint her a person to prepare with. This goes on for a week, no one talking to her, no one interacting with her. She asked the teacher, can you find a way to get me more integrated with the other students? And the teacher says, you need to be more assertive. Go introduce yourself. She says, I'm the visitor. I'm the new person. Shouldn't you? You know, and so she ultimately drops the class, something that she had fallen in love with as a young child. And there's all of these kinds of stories that go on in this university and probably every university in this campus that has real impact on the individual student as well as reflects the nature of the society that we actually live in.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Cindy Adachajuwa, the Director of the African American Studies Program here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. I'm Bob McChesney, your host here on Media Matters and WILL AM 580. Today we're pre-recording the show a few days before going on air, so please don't call in. Just sit back, relax. Let Professor Chajua and myself do the yakking today. We've been talking about a series of racist incidents that have taken place at the University of Illinois campus in the past year and trying to put it in context. Cindiata, how much of this do you think is due to the fact that, on one hand, this university campus, like most American university campuses, is dominated overwhelmingly by European-American white people? There's just not as many people of color. So this sort of culture can go on and not get called on. I mean, it'd be less likely to happen in a university with a significant population of students of color. And then secondly, while you're thinking of your answer to the first part, one of the trends in the United States in the past 25, 30 years has been a real increase in income inequality. And with that, a lot of the gains that have been made in the 1950s, 60s, and into the 70s with not just students of color, but working class students across the board coming to universities like the University of Illinois have been lost. And increasingly, it's all the faculty and my friends at other universities, we see this. One, these land-grant schools are increasingly the province of the upper middle class. I mean, there are, not to say they're all upper middle class, but it's more of a private school feel, like you would have gotten at a Northwestern 25 or 30 years ago than today here. How much is that a factor, too?
Well, I'm glad you linked those two things in terms of questions, because they actually do converge to explain what's going on. In regard to the first part, I would actually come at it from the opposite end, that what we've actually seen is the growth of students of color. I think Asian American students constitute 13%, African American 7%, and Latino students about 7%. So collectively, more than a quarter of the students now are of color.
Okay.
I think that we've reached a tipping point, and this resurgence of racism is in part about the changing nature of the campus, both in terms of student population, but also in terms of the curriculum. These students are going to mainly Chicago northern suburban students, who in the class that you've been describing, are having to go into classrooms and experience things that they're not prepared to accept, understand, or grapple with at this stage. The second part of your piece is that, as we've seen, you know, this goes back to the Reagan era, the withdrawing, the whole basis of neoliberal policy to withdraw the funding of public institutions and to leave those things to the market. And that the university's response to that has been to increase tuition, to seek greater foundation and gift money in order to replace what's been withdrawn from the state. And in that process, then, the composition of the students in terms of class has shifted dramatically. Even in terms of students of color, you now have the bourgeois and petty bourgeois sectors of those communities more often than students from the inner city, working class students across the board. And you're going to get an increase in racist incidents when you make that kind of class shift. You know, this is the strange secret of American history. We're always taught that it's the quote-unquote uneducated, the ignorant, the poor, the white working class that are the basis of racism and other forms of bigotry.
The Archie Bunkers
of the world.
Yeah.
You know, and it's actually amazing that people could have ever bought into that, because the reality is that the class that has always decided in this country, right? They've always, even when there have been upsurges and social movements led by working class people based on racial exclusion, the ultimate power has always lied in the hands of those who controlled the corporations, and they decided whether or not they would adopt that exclusion or not. When they didn't want to, they didn't. So at the end of the day, we have to understand where that policy comes from and what's pushing it. So we're seeing the consequences of that shift in the population, as well as a failure. You know, I can't reiterate this more. A failure of leadership at the very top. I think that within the campus leadership, they are trying to grapple with this.
Mm-hmm.
But there is also a real problem in terms of faculty. I've sat in meetings where the provost, Linda Katehi, engaged in a broad-based discussion on the racial climate on campus with a number of faculty. And I have to say that the people that perhaps to the outside look as if they're progressive individuals who do a lot of this new research.
Now, for those of you at home, this isn't on video. New research got air quotation marks around it.
sit there with disinterest, disgust, and disdain on their face because they did not want to engage in that kind of discussion because that's not what they're into. Because what they're teaching in the classroom is that you have to decenter race, right? They're teaching in the classroom that there is no power in a society, that every individual interaction involves power. And so we can't talk about things like institutionalized racism. We can't talk about things like state power, corporate power, that we have to talk about the power of the individual and how that's used, da-da-da-da-da. And that kind of nonsense makes it impossible for these students to understand that we live in a society that's structured to produce racial inequities, that's structured to produce gender inequities, that's structured to reproduce class inequities, and that all of these things, you know, converge, collide, diverge in ways that over time keep black people, people of color, women, working class people on the bottom of the society. And so I think that there's a real connection in this particular resurgence of racist ideology and the ways in which these post-structuralist theories get disseminated across this campus.
Our guest, Sundiata Chajua, director of the African American Studies Program here at the University of Illinois. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. Again, we taped this shortly before going on air, so sit back, relax, enjoy yourselves. Sundiata, the point you were just making is so important, especially, I think, there is this common perception that, well, working class whites are a bunch of bigoted loons, uncouth and vulgar. And if they were only educated and good like upper middle class whites, we'd live in a perfect world. Because, of course, upper middle class whites, the people who run this country, upper class whites, have no bias, no prejudice, and they certainly would never say the N-word. Now, the Imus incident was interesting to me in a lot of ways because of exactly this point. Because I remember when the Imus thing happened, I was talking to people who never watched the Imus show, don't listen to radio, and they're going, well, isn't he just one of these Howard Stern shock jocks? Isn't he just another one of these guys who titillates 18 to 34-year-old working-class men with stories about with racism and sexism and misogyny and talking about women's tits and stuff? And, it was clear they had no idea that the Imus show was actually much more, I think, following your thesis.
Yeah, the Imus piece is interesting for a number of reasons. The first is that, when you watch sports, and I watch a lot of basketball and football, not baseball too much, but anyway, when you watch sports, one of the things you become becomes almost normal is the animalization of African American athletes, but you always hear it about male athletes, right? It's far more masked and evasive in discussions of women athletes. What Imus did was completely pull the cover off of that. And if you looked at how he did, he built on historic stereotypes of black people, right? Black women. So he basically, what he did is he masculized them and he turned them into gangsters. Right. Mm-hmm. And then he turned them into promiscuous women. Mm-hmm. These are historic, traditionally. You can find these stereotypes in every period of African-American history. They become prevalent, mm-hmm, as a way to demean African-American women, the black community in general, and to try and explain differences in community and family structure that are structural and speak to different functions, right? Mm-hmm. Might speak to greater community as opposed to an individualistic approach. But he did that in a way that was mocking. That's what I find interesting, is that he's mocking. There's nothing wrong with saying someone has nappy hair, mm-hmm, right? In the form of it can be a neutral phrase. But nappy-headed holes,
yeah.
Right, is not. And then what the other trick that happens after I must put that out there is that rather than deal with white racism, right, and deregulation of media and how that's fueled and made it more possible for these kinds of things to happen, they immediately switch it into talking about rap music.
Yeah.
Now, there's a lot to loathe in rap music,
mm-hmm,
but if someone believes that rappers have made the N-word popular, right?
They didn't invent the N-word.
Right, they didn't invent it. That's absurd, right?
Yeah.
And the other thing is that we're talking about artists who produce a product for the market, right? Meaning that it's the desire of the producer, of the people who own the record companies, the recording industry, who distribute records, the media that play and make things popular, that has much more to say about what an artist will produce or create that actually hits the marketplace than the individual ideas of any particular artist. So, for example, to make this point as clear as I can, mm-hmm, when rap music was by and large progressive, right, the late 80s, early 90s, when it was dominated by black radical and black nationalist thought, and it was widely progressive, the response of the creation of gangster rap, why did gangster rap win out in the battle with progressive rap?
Mm-hmm.
Why even today when you have large numbers of very popular, right, progressive rap artists, The Coup, Common, Kanye West, on and on and on, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why are these people's sales and their promotion far less than some of the more vulgar and simplistic acts? And that has to do with the corporations. It has to do with the fact that after about 600,000 issues, right, of a record, that's about where black purchasing ends.
Mm-hmm.
Black consumer base for any rap album is about 600,000. After that, when they go double platinum, that's all white kids
mm-hmm.
buying that. So that the marketing of this stuff and its actual consumer base is very different than the rappers themselves. And so once we begin to factor that in and analyze, and then look more complexly at rappers, same way you look more complexly at...
One second, because, you know, we had Davey D on about 3 or 4 weeks ago on the show, and he went at length about, because he was, you know, he's a hip-hop historian. He was present at the creation in the Bronx in the 70s. And he talked exactly in detail about what you just described, how in the 1980s, you know, there was this community of progressive rappers, and they were leading the fight against derogatory, misogynist terms for women.
Yes.
I mean, they were not, it's not like this is a unified everything gangster rap community, but they were leading the fight and getting no publicity in the mainstream media. And as you said, their music was getting aced out by the big labels. I mean, that wasn't, this was a decision made not by the community of artists nor by listeners as much as by labels saying, this is the route we want to go. And I think he was fairly eloquent. And listeners, you can go get that podcast and download the show if you want to get more elaboration on this point. And one other point that you raised, I think it's interesting. As you pointed out, deregulation of radio station ownership has taken place in the last 10 years, and the number of African-American-owned or minority-owned stations has plummeted. The people at Free Press did some research, and they found out that the IMUS radio show is not carried on a single minority-owned station in this country. No, but it shows the importance of ownership,
that's
possibly,
right,
in terms of what the content is.
You know, I agree with you. And you had shown some of those figures to me before, that one of the things that deregulation across the board has done is that it's weakened blacks in terms of their ability in the media sector. They may have grown in other sectors, but in the media sector, where it's critical to get alternative voices out, that market has been handicapped and has shrunk decidedly. Even when we take BET... Now, I'm not proposing that BET was ever great.
That was originally U of I alum Bob Johnson. His invention that was then later sold to Viacom.
Viacom. But before the purchase to Viacom, BET had a large number of public interest programming. The Tavis Smiley that we get on NPR is a Peller, softer version of the Tavis Smiley that had the Tavis Smiley show on BET. There were a number of hard-hitting public affairs shows on BET. Once it was shown, sold to Viacom, that's the first thing that they eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The George Curry show lead-in, the top black journalist analyzing the week's news, they took that out. They took out everything that was progressive that brought the black intellectual, the black activist community to BET. They eliminated those sectors. So that speaks in part to how BET turned into this thing that it is now. Now, we do have hopes that Reginald Hudlin will be able to transform it, but he definitely has his work cut out for him.
Our guest, Sundiata Chajuwa, the professor and director of the African American Studies Program here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. My name is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. This is WILL AM 580. We're a little over halfway through our show. And those of you tuning in, just want to remind you that this show we taped shortly before going on air. So sit back, relax, and let the two professors do the yakking today, something we enjoy doing. We had a long list of things we wanted to talk about on this show, and I want to make sure we touch on a number of them because there's been just a lot of interest around a number of these issues. And the one I want to go to now is the junior senator from our state, Barack Obama, is now a candidate for president of the United States. And Obama has become a very interesting cultural figure. And he looks to be right now probably the best opportunity an African-American has had to win this office of White House, I think, easily at this stage. In terms of polling, financial support, he is truly a legitimate candidate to become the next president of the United States. And he's also become somewhat of a debated entity in the African-American community, not only for that, but for a variety of reasons. What's your take on Obama?
I think that if we're talking about the kind of simplistic debate that the mainstream media has tried to argue is central to the black community, that Obama's not an African-American, that's obviously just foolishness. Mm-hmm. Obama has a background that, while it has some real unique aspects, being raised part of his life in Hawaii, part of the time in Asia, that's unusual. But his parentage is not unusual mm-hmm. in the African-American community. And so then we start with what makes a person...
His parentage, just so we're clear.
His mother's from Kansas, his father's from Kenya. You've got probably somewhere around 10% of the black population in the U.S. now are people who were either born on the African continent or in the West Indies and then immigrated here, or they were born here of parents from other parts of the African diaspora. That's fairly common in a large number of black communities.
So a fairly significant percentage of the population did not come through the American plantation slave experience.
Right, absolutely. About 10%. So that's not unusual. The question becomes, how do they understand the experience after they've been here? And like most immigrants, right, the first generation, they're strivers. Mm-hmm. They were educated outside this social formation, so they're this society, so they have a different perspective, and they come with hopes and dreams, and they're hard workers. The second generation, they're educated in this society, and they understand the society from the standpoint of its realities in ways that their parents didn't. So that second generation, most often, if they're of African descent, they articulate to African-American society, African-American culture, because that's the way they're dealt with by the rest of the society. If you read Obama's books, it's very clear that he became an African-American through his social experiences. If you look at his life choices, right, he chose to come back, take a low-paying job working as a community organizer to improve the lives of black people on the west side of Chicago and the south side of Chicago. That's what he selected. The church he selected an African-American, Afrocentric church. You look at the choices that people make, and that gives you a sense of who they are. So to talk about Obama as being somehow not African-American is an attempt to foment a divisive conversation in the black community to undermine support.
It's a bogus.
It's completely bogus, mm-hmm. right? Then if you look at the politics that he's practiced from what we've known him in office when he was in the state legislature, Obama was clearly one of the best mm-hmm. African-American politicians in terms of speaking to the interests of African-Americans.
Our guest, Sundiata Chajua, director of the African American Studies program here at the University of Illinois. We're talking about racism on the campus at the U of I and some of the recent stories that have been breaking. Professor Chajua's research has been on the history of African American communities in the United States. And we've spoken at length with him in previous shows on that subject and on Black Power as well. This is a pre-recorded show, again, to remind you, because I know people would want to call in to talk to you, Sundiata. So please don't try to call in today. We'll get a live show with you at some point down the road when we come back. One of the things that came up on the heels of the Imus episode.
Well, could we go back to Obama? Because there's another side.
Go ahead. On the heels of the Imus episode, it came out that Rush Limbaugh was on his radio program airing I can't recall exactly. It's a Obama the Dancing.
Obama the Magic Negro.
To the theme of Puff the Magic Dragon.
Yes.
And this, you know, maybe it's coincidental that it was on the heels of the Imus thing, but it immediately. Are we in a moment where an African American is going to be subject to a type of humor that really wouldn't have been thinkable 5 or 10 years ago, where issues of, like, their race become something that's discussed rather than the content of what they're running on?
Well, let's be clear that we're in that moment, yeah. Right? And the best example of that is this this actor by the name of Charles Kipp. He's a comedian, and he's created this blackface minstrel character in the form of a black woman. And he goes doing these racist parodies, and he's become quite popular.
I confess, I'm completely out of the loop here. Is he on TV or Vegas?
He's doing the comedy circuit. Mm-hmm. This past February, a coalition in L.A. Prevented the comedy show from having him appear. But he's got a website with this character. What is her name? I think it's Mama D. Beer, you know, alcoholic character. I mean, it's sick. Mm-hmm. But he's kind of... He's, as I said, he's very popular with young people, and you know the Messina. Oh man, this guy Carlos Messina, this guy is terrible. You know, he legitimizes every kind of anti-Latino joke you would ever want to make because he does it, right? Mm-hmm. So that stuff has already been legitimized. What Rush Limbaugh is doing is a direct, conscious response to the groundswell against Imus, and Limbaugh figures he can get away with it because Obama's a public figure. Mm-hmm. That's the calculation. And that's what makes it, you know, particularly dangerous is that because he's a public figure, Limbaugh may be allowed to continue this racist parody. But what it shows us, right, that at the same time that there's an effort to foment a divisive discussion in the black community, a discussion that really hasn't gone anywhere other than, you know, the fact that the New York Times continues to run articles. You know, a quick little thing about the New York Times.
Sure.
You know, generally if you read something in the New York Times, you're black, and it's about black people, you know that you just discount it. Mm-hmm. They like a book, they like a movie. It's got to be an anti-black book, anti-black movie. Mm-hmm. That's the legacy of that particular publication. It's horrible when it comes to black people. They just like to foment negative stuff. But back to the Obama piece here, that on the white side then, what they're doing is building the movement against Obama so that at the same time, everything you said is true. He's raising a lot of money. He's got media attention. He's quote unquote a rock star. And it looks like when you poll people that they say they'll vote for him. They also say they vote for Harold Ford. And they say they'll vote for a large number of black candidates historically. But when the vote actually occurs, mm-hmm. that's not what happens. But Obama has certainly created some concern. But at the exact same time that we see those things, we also see that NBC.com? Mm-hmm. That they have these websites where you can comment on each presidential candidate, and they had to take the Obama one off the offline because the comments had become so racist, right? I should say that the not only the intensity of the racism but the volume had grown so much that they had to remove that website, and so then we see Rush Limbaugh and his parody, so that we're getting. You know, divergent signals here. In fact, I would argue that his popularity and his possibilities are galvanizing the response to undercut it. And we know that he recently had to get a Secret Service protection at quite an early stage yeah. in the campaign because of the racist attacks. So, you know, we've got to read these things carefully because they appear to be different messages, but I think they're reflections of the same phenomena.
Do you think he could win a national election?
I think he can win the Democratic primary, but
nomination.
He can, yeah, he can win the Democratic nomination. This is the United States of America.
That So I'll take that as a
probably
not.
That to expect a smart, savvy black person or woman to win in the United States at this historic moment. I'm not crazy.
Well, what about Hillary Clinton, speaking of a smart woman? And she's running for president. And I think the similarity to Obama would be that as a woman, she takes sort of a discussion on gender and sex role issues that no male or white male specifically has ever really had to face and is facing in the current race. Are there similarities beyond that, or is it mostly dissimilarities?
I think that Hillary, like Bill, remember, they came out of Democratic Leadership Council, mm-hmm. which was the right wing of the Democratic Party asserting itself in relationship to Jesse Jackson's presidential campaign. See, people want to forget that side of the Clinton legacy. And the Clinton years were not good for black people. They were horrible for black people. Clinton was horrible for black people. He was good for a small sector of the black capitalist class. Mm-hmm. That's all. He was terrible for black people. He abolished welfare. He supported a terrorism bill that led to the Patriot Act. His whole thing was to flood the society with police. I mean, Clinton, we can go on and on about Bill Clinton in terms of his policy. I don't care about the moral questions. But, no, Hillary, again, I don't think that she compares to Obama in terms of their political position. And, again, I'm looking at Obama as a person who's in the Illinois State House was very progressive. The Illinois State Senate was very progressive. And his domestic articulations are progressive, not so much as foreign policy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Clinton is far more moderate, and we know that the Clintons generally are testing the polls and the win in terms of the position she takes. Obama was opposed to the war. Hillary supported the war. And we can go on and on. So they're similar in that they would be first for their respect them, but their policies are not the same. They're not the same politician.
Our guest, Cindy Adachajewa, again, from the program on African-American Studies here at the University of Illinois. Just got a few minutes left, Cindy Ada. And I'd sort of like to go back to your own research historically, which was the topic of our interview, I think, two shows ago, which was, I mean, you've written at length on the African-American community in the late 19th, early 20th century, this period coming out of Reconstruction, going into Jim Crow, which you've termed the nadir, which is...
Well, actually, Rayford Logan termed that period the nadir.
The nadir.
I'm terming the period going out of... from the rise of global capital around 1980 to the present, I'm terming the new nadir for African Americans.
And I think the reason why this is interesting is that I think in mainstream parlance, and if you were to go on mainstream news media, the sort of conventional wisdom, okay, I'm a sort of slipped up, and okay, Rush Limbaugh's a little over the edge. But in general, you know, things have, you know, we've gotten rid of formal racism. The Jim Crow laws are out of the way. You know, we've really made tremendous progress, and now pretty much if African Americans aren't succeeding, basically it's because they're listening to too much hip-hop music and not, you know, sucking it up and working hard enough, and that the system's working now. Your argument is basically that's absolutely incorrect. Could you explain a little bit more?
Well, let's take the most important aspect of life is living, right? How long you live and the quality of that life.
Yeah.
So on life expectancy, over the last 20 years, African Americans have grown to live much longer than they ever had before. Black women live longer than men. I think they live to be about 79. Black men live to be about 75, 73 or so, which is longer than blacks have ever lived, right? But in that same period, the gap in life expectancy between whites and blacks grew. Mm-hmm. So the distance... Right. The gap has increased. Mm-hmm. OK, so that's one piece there that we need to factor in. In terms of other quality of life indicators. Right. When you compare median income, what you find is that African-American median income is back to where it was in the early 60s as a percentage of white median income.
It's going backwards.
It's going backwards. If we're talking about wealth, the wealth index, which is far more significant than even the income index, right?
Mm-hmm.
Blacks make, if you count house, the home, right?
Which is a primary source of wealth.
Which is primary source of wealth for working class people, right?
Class people.
Then blacks have 12% of the wealth of whites.
Mm-hmm.
If you eliminate home, it's 1%.
That's the real investment capital.
That
runs the economy.
Okay. So when you put it on those kind of bases, and we can take other forms of quality of life indicators, right? African Americans exist as a third world population inside the U.S. in terms of death from diseases, preventable diseases, right? So at that level, right, quality of life, all those social indicators, things have, by and large, regressed. And if we start talking about things like prison,
yeah,
right? Before the criminal Ronald Reagan passed the Drug Act of 1986, whites outnumbered blacks in state penitentiaries something like, let's say that the gap was about 25,000 or something like that, right? By the time we get a decade later, 1996, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not only has prison population gone from like 200,000 to, you know, more than a million.
And we're at 2 million today.
Well, now it's 2 million a day, right? But blacks suddenly now are more than 2 to 1 in regards to whites, where a decade before there were more whites in prison. Currently, right, 1/3 of the African-American male population at any point in time is either on probation, right, in court about to be sentenced, in jail, or on parole.
Mm-hmm.
There have been since the end of the 80s, first part of the 90s, more black youth between the ages of 18 and 25 in prison than in college. And that includes junior colleges, community colleges, okay? So when you begin to factor those kinds of things on, and you, even if you just stop and ask yourself, well, what's the impact of having 1/3 of the male population incarcerated? What's the impact to a community? That's one way we can explain the negative aspects of gangster rap, because much of what gangster rap is prison culture.
Yeah.
Right? Other thing, the increase of the explosion of AIDS in the black community affecting black women. There's a relationship between that 1/3 black male population being incarcerated where prison authorities sanction, right? Rape. And other forms of abuse. And you can take almost any category, and we can show you that we've moved backwards. If we're looking at those objects, you know, the U.S. Census data shows this. So to think about this as a period of progress, you only do that because you focus in on the Oprahs, the Bob Johnsons, and you don't look at the devastation of the community, even on things that presumably white liberals value, like interaction across race, right? Mm-hmm. The index of dissimilarity in terms of housing integration. We live in a society that is more segregated today than it was in the mid-60s, and it's near the levels that it was in the late 50s, right? Only about 1/3 of black youth actually interact with white students at the elementary, secondary school level across the country. We've seen greater segregation in schooling. And then when you talk about the ones who are in integrated schools, the school itself is segregated in terms of the way the classes are actually constructed. So we live in a society that's more like the early 60s, the late 50s, than the 70s and late 60s were.
Let me ask you a question, Sundiata Chajua. There's a fairly famous sociologist who was trying to explain why, by statistical measures, in Scandinavian countries, women did so much better vis-a-vis men there than they did in the United States, even though they're at the time of the research, there was no feminist movement to speak of in these countries, but there was a fairly strong feminist women's movement in the United States. And his argument was that the reason was that the social democratic and labor movements in those countries, when they put into place things like universal health care and education, they automatically applied to everyone in society. So it gave a basis and a foundation for women to be successful, taking advantage of these benefits that were given to the entire population of the country that were won by these labor governments. And as I listen to you talk about this this real attack on the African-American community, I want to tie it back to what we talked about earlier, which you've talked about too, which is we've seen in the last 30 years, more broadly, a real increase in inequality in the United States. And a real, even though we aren't taking calls, someone's trying to call us now and Cindy had a cell phone. There we go. But we've seen a real increase in inequality. How much, and I know this is something I've thought about a lot, and I know you have too. Where do we understand how these two things play together? The racism, the racial history of this country, and then the current growth of inequality and how that affects poor people and working class people disproportionately.
You know, on the one hand, it's simple in that we know that black people have always been, are largely working class. I saw one study that shows that if you trace across time, the African American community by and large has been somewhere between 88 and 92, 93% working class since the end of slavery, right? So clearly, the black community is lodged there, and that's fairly easy to show. Where it becomes more complex is that the history of labor movements and progressive movements in this country, those movements have also been highly racist, and that we end up, you know, what you're suggesting is that a kind of universal approach would resolve this. And I'd say that, well, the New Deal was... But the kind of universalism of, say, a New Deal or a Great Society, clearly those are not things that I would oppose, but they come with racial flaws, right? So that what we would argue is something that would combine the particularities of a real affirmative action program, actually reparations, to be quite frank, is what I argue for, is straight up reparations, combined with something that goes further and deeper than the New Deal attempted to do.
You know, I could talk to you all day, and I'd love to go into this particular issue for an entire show, and we might have to do that, but we aren't going to do it in this show, because unfortunately we're winding down now. We've only got about a minute left in the show before we wind up here. And I just, you know, are there any sort of closing comments, stuff we haven't gotten to that you'd like to make sure we touch on before the show ends?
You know, I would say that it's real important for the broader society to not support the effort to elect board of trustees, that that's in a response to the removal of a racist symbol.
Here in Illinois.
And a very clear attempt to push us back in a number of ways.
Well, Sundiata Chajua, thank you so much for being our guest today on Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney, your host here. We'll be back again 1 week from today. And I do want to thank Jay Pierce, station manager, for sitting in as our guest engineer today. It's been an honor to have you in the room with us. See you all next week, everyone.